enter the world of Ho Lai, Reb Brown, and so many heroes named Steve. 80s action movies on the cheap is filled with insightful reviews about the films made during the decade that gave us big hair, shoulder pads, and yuppies. This book is an excellent guide through the action movies that didn't quite make blockbuster status, or in some cases, any status at all. Written with wit, good humor, a definite fondness, and minimal spoilers, this book is a must-have for film lovers. 80s Action Movies on the Cheap by Daniel R. Budnick is available now at Amazon and McFarlane Books.
All right. Hey, everybody. It's Dan. Welcome to Eventually Supertrain episode 46. Again, that great ad was created by our friend Rustin Willpower, and that was the wonderful Kiki Wrights, a.k.a. Kristen Hawes, doing a little chatter about my second book, 80s Action Movies on the Cheap. You should buy it. But regardless of how awesome that is, episode 46, here we are. We're talking episode, 14 of Green Hornet, episode 12 of Ellery Queen Mysteries, and episode 2 of Bourbon Street Beat. You guys are going to have a great time. Although I do apologize again, Kristen is not in this one. That's my goof. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Maybe one day that'll change. But let's get to it anyways. Mr. Dozier?
Another challenge for the Green Hornet. His aide, Kato, and their rolling arsenal, the Black Beauty. On police records, a wanted criminal, the Green Hornet is really Britt Reed, owner-publisher of the Daily Sentinel. His dual identity known only to his secretary and to the district attorney. And now, to protect the rights and lives of decent citizens, rides the Green Hornet.
All right, everyone, welcome to episode 14 of the Green Hornet Freeway to Death, December 16th, 1966. Written by Ken Pettis, directed by Alan Reisner, this freeway to death is the Skyline Freeway, which is being built by Crown Construction. And the episode begins late at night, although it's a bit day for nighty, with good old Mike, poor Mike, showing up at the empty construction site. And there is a guy there who is willing to, for I believe $1,000, give information on the Crown Company insurance racket. There's some sort of racket going on with this construction company insurance racket. And just as this guy's about to give Mike the info, all of a sudden a bulldozer smashes into the sort of shed trailer thing that they're in, kills the guy, and Mike is about to get killed when the Green Hornet shows up and rescues him, and boy, is Mike's face red.
We got here just in time, didn't we, Axford? Did you get it?
Get what?
The name of the man behind the construction company insurance racket. Was it Emmett Crown? You offered to give that night watchman $1,000 for the name. Was it Crown? Well?
I don't know. He was killed before he could tell me.
Then I have a proposition for you. I want the name, too. If we work together, we can get it.
Working together?
You want to expose the Mammoth Insurance Company. I want to eliminate competition. Working together...
I wouldn't work with you if...
Shouldn't you discuss that with your employer first?
I don't have to ask him. I know Britt Reed. I know what he'd say.
Do it, Mike.
Do it?
I'd cooperate with Satan himself to smash Crown and his operation.
Satan is one thing, but working with the Green Hornet. Besides, we haven't any proof it is Crown.
Can you think of a better way of getting it? It takes a thief to catch a thief.
Britt, will you listen to me?
It's all settled, Mike. When the Green Hornet contacts you, you tell him you'll meet him any place, any time, ready to cooperate completely.
So thus begins an elaborate, or as elaborate as a 25-minute episode of Green Hornet will get, little schemey thing where you've got Crown, played by Jeffrey Hunter, who is possibly involved in some sort of scam with a bunch of insurance guys, and Britt Reed goes over to talk to Crown and sort of mentions that Mike's kind of gets a little boozy and he kind of needs money, so, you know, be wary of him, this, that, and the other thing. And Hornet has sort of his standard, wants to get involved in the take of everything to try to infiltrate and stop this racket from happening. And Britt, when he goes to visit the Crown site, he almost has a huge piece of machinery. Well, he has a huge piece of machinery dropped very near him. He gets out of the way of it. And there's a moment where the Hornet and Kato and Mike go into the insurance office and get in a big fight with all these insurance agents who are suddenly very fisticuff crazy, and they're basically there because they want to join in on the scam. And so the insurance guys call the guy in charge, who turns out to be Crown, and this happens.
Hello.
Yeah, the Green Hornet.
And Mike Axford of the Daily Sentinel.
Axford?
Yes, they say they have some information that you might be interested in. They want to meet with you.
Maybe we didn't get to Wiggins quite soon enough last night, huh?
Maybe. And maybe they're just bluffing.
No, Axford being there might figure. But Reed says he's a lush and he's got money problems. Wiggins did talk. Maybe Axford figured he'd hook up with the Green Hornet and cash in big once and for all. Now listen, ask him if it's okay if we contact Axford to set a time and a place for tomorrow night.
He wants to meet with you tomorrow night. Now, he'll be in touch with Axford. We'll let you know where and when.
That's fine, but don't get cute. Let's go.
They said okay and left. The Green Hornet said not to try anything.
I'm not gonna try anything. I'm just gonna do it.
Which is a great way to end any conversation. So yeah, they're gonna meet up with him later that night. They're gonna contact the insurance company's gonna contact Mike, and what ends up happening is that Mike gets the call. And, here's what ends up happening. You can hear all of it.
Brent's gone?
Mm-hmm.
You know where I can reach him?
He took some work home with him, Mike. Mike, if you're going to bug him again about working with the Green Hornet, you'd better forget it.
But I tried to...
Excuse me. Mr. Reed's office? Yes, just a moment, please. Mike, it's for you. I'll be in the city room.
Axford speaking.
Axford, this is Clinton Giles. Meet me in front of my office building at 10 o'clock tonight.
Completely going against the Green Hornet's wishes. Yeah, Mike heads on out to the site to arrange this deal, and Mike has some information. Yeah, like he said, and he's going to sell it. And of course, the bad guys have bulldozers. Now, I'm not going to ruin it, but there is sort of a bulldozer Black Beauty fight that goes on here, and I'll just leave it at that. But yeah, that's Freeway to Death in a nutshell. I tried to streamline it as best I could right here. But yeah, it's basically some sort of insurance racket trying to find out who it is that's involved, bringing Mike into it, Green Hornet. Overall, this is a pretty fun episode of the show. You get Jeffrey Hunter in it as the bad guy, and you get lots of Mike, and Mike just being completely confused by the fact that now he somehow found himself working with the Green Hornet, which he doesn't seem to fully understand. And you get that weird... I wish you could see it. That's like it's just a bunch of insurance executives sitting around a table, and they're discussing whatever their scam is that they're up to. And all of a sudden, the Green Hornet, Kato, and Mike come in, and all the insurance agents suddenly leap up and they start brawling with Kato, the Green Hornet. And Mike gets in and he gets to throw a punch or two. It's just a weird sequence. You don't normally expect that from like insurance executives, but hey, to each their own. There's an interesting moment near the end of this one with Mike where we see it doesn't quite become poor Mike in the end. The Green Hornet saves him from the bulldozers. But there is a final sequence where Mike is telling his story to the other reporters. You know, these young punks, they don't know, you know, what I was like 30 years ago, and now's my big chance. And sort of Green Hornet leaves Mike kind of as the hero of the situation, and the episode actually ends with, in the foreground in Britt's office, you see Miss Case and Britt watching Mike as Mike is out in the newsroom. Miss Case start laughing, and it's all a good time and stuff like that. But yeah, this is a nice Mike heavy episode. Although Britt too gets a couple of nice moments in there. He has that scene with Jeffrey Hunter there where they're kind of trying to, I guess, sort of out hunk one another in this trailer thing with Britt throwing down these little things about, Mike, he is known to have a drink, and I know he's got a problem. I forget if he says with gambling or what it is, but no, he's got a problem, so he may be out to, do something or other, you know, kind of laying the seeds of Mike being kind of a shifty fella. And yeah, it's interesting to see the Green Hornet and Mike together, because during that scene where Green Hornet, which you heard earlier, where Green Hornet says to Mike, you know, we're going to work together, Mike has just been rescued from the clutches of that bulldozer, and his face is like all marked up with dirt and everything like that, so he looks a little bit more, you know, poor Mike than usual at that moment, as he's being asked to compromise everything he knows in order to work with the Green Hornet. And let's talk bulldozers as a weapon. Now, killdozer is one thing, but bulldozers, they're giant and they're loud, and they it's interesting because the way it's done in the first scene is the two of them are talking, Mike and the informant are talking in the trailer, and it's like, what's that noise? I don't know, it sounds like a bulldozer. And then you look out and the bulldozer's right there and smashes into him. But the other parts, the bulldozer is sort of at a distance, you know, so it's sort of, they're not the fastest machines around. The Black Beauty could outrun a bulldozer, is basically what I'm saying. But it is fun because there is a moment like where the bulldozers surround them. It's like, oh, hey, this is a little... Lots and lots of scams going on in this. I guess there are lots and lots of scams going on in every city. There's always a new, like a lot of insurance scams and a lot of construction scams. And it's funny because the actual sort of scams themselves are, it's a little vague exactly on what's going on. I mean, it's not completely vague, but it's sort of like, what exactly is going on with these scams? I don't think it really matters at the end of the day. We're just here to have some fun with it and catch some bad guys who have crazy bulldozers and are going after everybody with them. Yeah, and Kato gets in some good smacking to the insurance agents, and a couple other more is large and in charge, and Miss Case gets mad at Mike, but then laughs along with Mike a little late in that world. As you can hear, without Kristen here, I don't have quite as much to say as I normally do. My apologies again, everyone. Things will be rectified soon. I just really wish I knew what she thought of this episode.
I like this episode. It has everything. Jeffrey Hunter in ridiculous glasses, bulldozers no one can escape, even though they're only going 2 miles an hour, Mike in peril, broad daylight, unsubtle murder attempts, Mike being accused of being a drunk, Mike being forced to work with the Green Hornet, brawling insurance execs, Mike double-crossing the Green Hornet, Mike in peril again, Mike swearing the double-cross was part of the plan the whole time, Mike getting to be the hero. It's a really swell episode.
Oh, hey, Kristen, thank you. Oh, she took off. Okay. Yeah, I guess I don't fully understand the way Skype works sometimes, but I guess that's what she thought of the episode, everyone, and that's the end of episode 14. What do we have next? I don't know. It's probably this.
Bourbon Street Beat. Bourbon Street Beat.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Starring Richard Long.
In New Orleans.
Andrew Duggan.
This is the blues.
With Arlene Howell and Van Williams. Produced by Warner Brothers.
Episode 2 of Bourbon Street Beat, The Morning Cloak, aired October 12th, 1959, the story of the Kavanaughs and Gray Oaks, an old plantation. That's got a little bit creepy. But what happens is, Melody, the secretary for Cal and Rex, gets a postcard. And she gets the postcard as Cal is moving in. Cal is now become a part. He's left Pelican Point. He's become a part of the Absinthe House Detective Agency. And he is moving in all his stuff. And we'll talk about Cal during our discussion of it. But he stays behind as Melody gets this, I was going to say email for a moment, the postcard from Julie Kavanaugh, who she went to school with. And she can tell by the postcard that she's in trouble in Gray Oaks, the old plantation manor house, crumbling Gothic, Southern Gothic manor house where she lives. She's in trouble, and Julie specifically requests that Rex be invited along. Rex goes, thunderstorm is approaching, they arrive, and they meet John Kavanaugh,
her father, and they meet her aunt, Della, who's very sort of Blanche DuBois. And they also meet Alexander, who is the butler for the house. And we sort of learn that it's very much what you'd expect. That it is a sort of a crumbling Southern Gothic mansion. John Cavanaugh is introduced as Rex and Melody are talking to Alexander. There's a huge thunder crash and bolt of lightning, and suddenly John is on the staircase, like, kind of imposing, but he's in front of like a piece of wall that is like torn away, and you can see sort of the brick facade underneath. Again, we'll talk about that later on, but this is one of those plantations where there's talk of, is there oil on this plantation? Maybe. There's definitely quicksand. And as they arrive, Melody is told that Julie is very sick and can't meet with anyone. But Julie immediately comes out and says, "Hell, Melody, oh my gosh, it's so great to see you." But it's like, "Oh no, Melody, you need to calm down." And then Della's introduced, and like I said, very Blanche DuBois. And Rex kind of falls for her line of, "We used to be so great, we used to be so wonderful, but now it's all fallen apart." And it's sort of similar-ish to what happened in the previous episode, but this is more sort of Southern Gothic. The previous episode was, yeah, definitely more Big Sleep kind of thing. This is more Southern Gothic. And so you get this family, the Cavanaughs, and you get, as the storm hits and Melody and Rex realize that they have to stay for the night, they get told a story about the Cavanaugh. The great-grandfather is a grandfather. It's some old guy who haunts the place, especially during thunderstorms. And so the night goes down, and Della and Rex have a long chat together, and it looks like they're about to smooch when Melody shows up. And Melody is going to her room after the power's gone out, and she sees some creepy stuff, and she sees an old guy kind of begin to wander into her room, and she screams, and it's crazy, and what's going on? Is that grandfather? Was that him? Was that his ghost? We don't know. But then Rex hears around midnight someone screaming, someone yelling out on the plantation, and the sort of noise of animals or something. And what's going on? What's going on? John kind of pushes it off, saying, it's just this, that, or the other thing. You know, some animals get trapped in the quicksand. But there's something going on, and it may involve the ghost, the Cavanaugh ghost. They do head back to the Absinthe house and get some information from Cal. But we learn, and this is where I'll stop, we learn that Alexander has been killed. We see Scantman Crothers, but Alexander has been killed. There is something going on at the Cavanaugh house. We need to find out what. And we'll probably talk about what during our chat, during my chat with the great Mitchell Hadley, which we will go to in a moment, right after this. I gotta tell you, whenever I watch an episode of this show, I will literally, when I'm done, spend the next 20 to 30 minutes just walking around going, Bourbon Street Beat, just doing singing the song, just those three words over and over again, and then I'll hum them. If I'm in the restroom at work, I'm standing in a stall humming that theme. It's very infectious, like all the themes for these four shows. So we are talking The Morning Cloak, and I am talking The Morning Cloak, the second episode of Bourbon Street Beat, with the great, the mighty Mitchell Hadley. Mitchell, how are you today?
I am well, Dan. How about you?
I'm good. I'm excited to dive into this one. Yes. Just gave everyone a little background. So please, let's do like we did last time. We'll start, just give me a broad overview and your thoughts, and then we'll go into more specific points. What did you think?
Well, I thought this was perhaps the obligatory Southern Gothic horror / mystery story. It has everything that you'd want. It has atmosphere. It has an old mansion. It has a thunder and lightning storm, ghosts, these skeletons in this old money, old Southern family closet. I suppose that every series that is set in the South has to have one of these. And I find it interesting that this was the second episode of Bourbon Street Beat where they do it. But I thought that it... and it was also interesting to mix it with a detective genre, because you don't always have those. You'll often have mysteries or murders in a gothic story, but you don't often have a private detective in the middle of it. So I thought that that was a very interesting combination for them to work on. And I also thought that, again, just broadly speaking, what I liked about this episode particularly was that it picks up where the last episode left off. At the end of the first episode, Cal has his bags, and he's there, and he's the new partner. And in this episode, he's unpacking, and he's putting up these pictures of these old movie stars, and so we're in his office, and so we're learning a little bit more about him. But they are not expecting that Cal is just going to jump headfirst into this. He's been a policeman. He's been done a lot of investigating, but he has never been a private detective before. And rather than just pretend that the second episode, well, it's business as usual, they're letting him ease into the storyline, and I like that.
Yeah, they do a really nice job of when he arrives, he puts up all these pictures, and they just spend a few minutes with him, just kind of shooting the breeze about the stars, and he talks about them. It's really nice, because we also get Rex doing his first sort of he's making mint juleps.
Yes.
And he's giving Melody some I've never had a mint julep.
Nor have I.
they look fun when he makes them, but he gives Melody some advice on what you do with the mint. You know, it's like you don't grate it, you do something else to it, mortar or pestle. I don't know what you do to it, but you do something else to it. And there's a great line where Melody says, you should write a cookbook, and he says, cooking with alcohol. And so he's got these mint juleps, and he goes
to the Cal. Graham lives.
And you get the thing with the postcard from Melody's friend Julie. So it's kind of nice in that, like you said, it does sort of take its time with the characters, because Melody says, Rex, Mr. Randolph, come with me to this old plantation house because I think there's something going on. And they mention that it's, you know, supposed to be haunted. And Rex says, Cal, you want to come with me? And he said, no, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice because he gets involved in the episode, but not that much.
It's an interesting parallel almost to the acting itself. It's almost as if he, as an actor, is saying, well, I'm the new man in the cast. I'm not going to intrude quite yet.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you guys, do your gothic thing. Melody can do some Cat in the Canary style screaming and running through halls, although that's not technically gothic, but still, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's interesting with this episode because it does have everything you sort of need. It's funny because it's not a mystery per se, because it's I'm trying to think, because like the last episode kind of had a nice mysteriness to it.
Yeah.
But this is more of like there is this legend of a ghost, and Melody sees things, and somebody dies, and then it's sort of like there's a big reveal. And it's almost like the big reveal, in some respects, might be something you guessed from something that happened earlier on. But at the same time, it's not really sort of a mystery per se.
No.
It's more of, I'm not sure what it is. It's a kind of a thriller, kind of almost, I don't know what it is. I was trying, because I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it's an episode that if you take out the regulars, it would be probably quite at home in an Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes, because you have her friend would be the one who's kind of like doesn't realize what's going on in the house and think it's haunted, and you know the rest of the family is denying what she's saying and that kind. No, you're absolutely right on. And I guess that's the one thing that I kind of don't like about the episode. I'll tell you one thing I do like: quicksand. You put quicksand in an episode, I'm in. There are certain things you put in. You put a hot air balloon, I'm in. Quicksand, I'm in. And there are a few other things, you know, I'm in.
That's funny you say that, because I don't have a lot of notes that I took on this episode, but I have one word scribbled across the bottom. It says quicksand.
Oh, I love quicksand. I love quicksand. Yeah, it's. I was trying to think of some other things that you put. I think the other thing is you have a fight sequence involving heights. That's another thing.
Well, and you know what I loved in this, the patriarch, as it were, of the family, played by John Hoyt, who's a really nice character actor. I enjoy watching him in almost anything that he's in, because there can be something very sinister about him, as there is in this episode. But in other shows like Hogan's Heroes, where he's in it three or four times, and almost always he invests his Nazi general type character with a sort of humanity that you don't always expect, and you always get the idea he's never one of the bad Nazis. He's a professional soldier.
Yes.
And I like how he can convey something like that. But what I really like is that every time he walks into a room in this episode, there's this crack of lightning and thunder. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, how do I get something like that? Wouldn't that be cool? Every time you walk into a room, boom, boom. It's better than having your own theme music.
Yes, it is.
Anybody can play theme music, but to have nature as your soundtrack.
Yeah. I one of the things that I do really like about this episode is this is sort of one of those, so far from the first two Bourbon Street Beats, it's sort of one of those shows where if it does humor, it's in a separate spot. The humor when it's doing dramatic stuff, it's not going to throw a joke in. But there was something about that with the thunder and lightning whenever he walks in the room, and just how much thunder and lightning was showing up in those scenes, that I thought someone is having a laugh. Someone's just taking the Southern Gothic and just turning it up just an extra notch.
It was very
nicely done. And here's the one thing I dislike about the episode is that I think it. I think your comment about if the main characters weren't in it, it would work just fine. And I think the problem is that about, I didn't actually time it, maybe halfway into it, they return to the office and they see a funeral and they learn that the butler has died. And they see Scatman Crothers twice, which was awesome, which surprised the heck out of me. And he shows up and he's pretending to play a clarinet, and I thought, Scatman, you're not playing that, but you're awesome. You are awesome. And it's funny because Scatman is like, he's like exposition Crothers or something, because it's like this funeral is going by, and Rex and Melody step forward and say, hey, who's this funeral for? And Scatman Crothers walks up and says, a guy named Franklin, and then he walks away. And then as the funeral's like going the other way and everyone's dancing, they have another question, and they step out, and he walks by, and he says, hey, what's this? And he gives the answer, and then he walks away, and I thought, no, that's awesome. but I think the one problem I did have with the episode is that I think they set up the atmosphere of this plantation house. It's stuff like little, well, this wasn't a little touch, but like when you first meet the patriarch there and he's coming down the steps, there's a huge patch of the wall where like the paint is gone. You can see like the brickwork or whatever it is underneath it. Like this is crumbling, literally. It's crumbling. Like they don't Stella? What is Della? the sort of Southern Belle, the older Southern Belle who Rex kind of falls for. She mentions at one point that they really don't have any money anymore, and there's sort of a feeling, like this is sort of going to collapse, like in 10-20 years, you know, this might be abandoned, and you know, with all the windows smashed out and just like this really haunted place. But yeah, and I keep going on tangents and missing why. I just think it's when they leave the house, it droops, I think.
Yes.
Because I think the it should have taken place all in one night.
Well, and you know, tied into that, because kind of the genesis of them leaving the house in the first place is that Melody, I suppose I should call her Melody Lee, since she keeps insisting. But you know, they're there because she's gotten this postcard from this dear friend, her BFF, and they're there, and first of all, she's told that her friend is sick and can't see anybody. And then she does see her, but she doesn't get a chance to talk to her. And then you've got all these weird things happening and this ghost, possibly, all these different things, and she's so scared she wants to go, and and it's like, well, you know, you dragged me down here because of your friend, and now because you're scared, you're ready to desert her and everything, when all these weird things may suggest that there she actually is in danger. And I was thinking, well, that's swell. I would love to have a friend like Melody. At the first sign of at the first sign of any kind of trouble, I'm out of here. And I don't think that is consistent with the Melody character, the way she's being developed. She seems to me like the kind of character who, naive though she may be, and seeing things like this that she's not comfortable with, she would be loyal. And I don't think she would be so anxious to jump out just because things were getting weird. I think she would owe it to her friend to stick around.
Yeah, it's sort of what I just imagine. Like, think of your favorite, like, old Dark House films, whatever they might be. One of my favorites is an old Dark Lighthouse film called Shh, the Octopus. If you could imagine, like, halfway into that, suddenly all the characters leave the lighthouse and go somewhere completely different for 15 minutes and then return in the end. I feel like it really and there's the fact that they just happen to be standing in the street when the guy who got killed at the mansion, his funeral is passing by. Yeah.
And what a coincidence.
It's so, I just think it would have worked better if they had just kept it at the house the whole time. And it would have been one night, and you would have learned everything. And it would have ended, like, in rain and darkness in quicksand, rather than... It sort of ends like a Most Dangerous Game-style thing, with a bad guy in a gun dressed like... is it Zaroff from Most Dangerous Game?
I think so, yeah.
As the good guy is sinking into quicksand. But it's during the day, and... I don't dislike the episode. I love the... until they leave the house... and return to the absinthe house. I like it quite a bit, and I like the ending because quicksand. I just think there's I don't know if I'd call it an error in the script, but I just think there's it's like I think if you're going to do a gothic horror like that, you need to kind of stick it. You can't wander away from it.
You almost wonder if at some point in time during the writing of the story that the scriptwriter couldn't figure out any other way to get the information in. And so, well, I'll have them go back to the absinthe house, and then I'll have them come back here, and because they'll see the funeral there in the city, and they'll get the information there, and then they'll realize they have to go back. Because you're right, not only does it kill the momentum, but you're looking at the clock, and it's only on the half hour of an hour long show. You know they've got to get back. Yeah. Why Jesus with something when you know that giving up on the case is not an acceptable or a plausible development?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you just know it's not something that's going to happen. So you wish they, I don't know. Maybe I forgot the name of the person who wrote this. Sig Herzig. I don't know who that is. I'm not familiar with that name. Sig, I think you nail it for about 40% of the episode. 60%. I'm sorry. The other 40, I'm a little vague on. But I just had a thought and it left me. Feel free to say something, Mitch, while I try to remember what it was I was thinking.
Oh, vamp here for a minute. Speaking of writers, I don't know if we'll ever get into this, but there are a number of episodes in Bourbon Street Beat I learned that are written by somebody called W. Hermanos.
Oh, I know that name. Yeah. Why do I know that name?
Well, W. Hermanos is a pseudonym for a number of people on the writing staff writing the episode together. And the W stands for Warner, and Hermanos is Spanish for brothers.
Brothers. Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I don't know. I was just charmed when I read that.
That's fantastic.
And there are several episodes later on that we'll come to where that's the writing credit, either in whole or in part, is given to W. Hermanos.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, we'll keep an eye out. You sure it wasn't Sig Herzig? That. I lost it again talking about Sig Herzig. I had a great point. Now I'm looking at my notes. Ghost of Grey Oaks, Express 7123 is the Absinthe House phone number. I've written that down a lot. And Franklin the butler has the world's deepest voice.
Oh, he should have been saying, "This is CNN."
Oh, that would have been great. Oh, yeah, he's got such an incredible voice. Yeah, and it's great because at the end of the episode, and we'll try not to give everything away, but it's one of those things where you get the gothic, you get the possible ghosts, you get a hidden secret locked away, you get oil, you get Nazis, you get quicksand. You literally, in like the last 5 minutes, you get everything.
Well, doppelgangers too. You've got that. That just completes it, doesn't it?
It's because you get one of everything in this episode.
If there's anything better than quicksand, it's quicksand and guns.
Yes.
And that's what you've got here. You've got quicksand and a gun, and that is never a good recipe.
No, because there is a moment where the bad guy is pointing it at the gun at Rex, and Rex is his back to the quicksand, and he says, "Okay, move." And Rex steps forward, and the guy says, "No, backwards." and Rex has a look on his face. He looks behind him, and he's got a look on his face like, "Oh, but this is a new suit." And it gets ruined.
Or can't you come up with a better line than that?
Yeah, exactly. I remember what my point was, and that is that there is a scene which is, I think, is a very well-acted scene, which is also a scene, I think, that during that portion when they return to the house almost kills the momentum completely dead, and that's when they go to visit Franklin's wife. And she's there in mourning with a bunch of her friends. And she talks about how she says some things that throw suspicion on one of the characters. And then she lets out some big wails. She lets some really good crying out. But at the same time, as good as she is, it's a weird scene where it's already slowed it down. Everything's already been slowed down. And then you get this scene where you want to feel the emotion, but you're also thinking, okay, now's the time to go back and get the ghost or whatever it is. You know, and it's like, I don't mean to sound juvenile, but let's get it moving.
Well, it's kind of like right scene, wrong show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This should have been in like a later episode where they didn't spend the night in a gothic mansion.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I said at the outset that you could see this in an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents as in the half-hour format. Because in a half-hour, tightly written plot show like this, you could see easily that would be a dynamite show for the Hitchcock format.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the more sort of you hear about the machinations of the bad guy involving Franklin in the funeral, the more it sort of begins to stretch a little bit, and you're like, huh, okay. I won't go too deep into it. You guys can watch the episode, but there is something about it where it's like I just really wish the writer could have just they would have just said, you know what, Sig, sit in that room for an hour and just come up with a way where they don't have to leave the house.
Yes.
Because I know the Absinthe House is a standing set, and we can use it whenever we want, but it's just it drags. It takes an episode which is really, I think, quite good, and kind of just puts it on the ground, like just for about 10 minutes, and then picks it back up for the end with quicksand. But still, yeah. Not, I don't dislike the episode. I just think there's an error in the script.
Yeah, I cannot disagree with that. I think that the episode left me indifferent, and I wonder, watching this series for the first time in 1959, after an initial episode that I really liked, I wonder how I'm reacting to this, because I'm not committed to watching the whole series. I could just as easily turn it off, and I'm thinking, now which episode is the real Bourbon Street Beat? Is it the first yes. one or the second one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you know, a few of my shows that I love, like Get Smart, does mm-hmm. the same sort of thing, where Mr. Big is just Mel Brooks and Buck Henry thinking of every single gag they can regarding the spy movies and such, and they throw everything in that 25 minutes, and it's funny, they hit on everything so perfectly that it's slightly tricky to watch now because we've seen everyone do variations of that joke for like 50 the jokes they did for like 50 years.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, it reminds me, going way off on a tangent here, but Judith Crist in when Shane made its television debut in the 60s, Judith Crist was reviewing it for TV Guide, and she said that Shane is full of the cliches that you have come to expect in Westerns, but Shane invented them.
Yes.
And that's the, she said, you have to understand that, is that this is the movie where all those cliches came from.
Yeah, it's like to take a spy thing, something like Goldfinger. You know, people there's a good chance you could sit someone down who's seen a ton of spy movies but never seen Goldfinger, and they're thinking like Austin Powers or something like that. You know, because this is sort of the movie that invented everything that sort of came after it. And I like that. With the Get Smart, and I'll say these real quick, and then we'll wrap up this episode. The first episode, Mr. Big, is super fun with all kinds of crazy stuff. But then that was the pilot. The second episode, Diplomat's Daughter with the Claw, or the Craw, if you'll forgive me, is the thing about Diplomat's Daughter is that it specifically feels to me like they got picked up for the show, and then everyone sat down and said, well, what do we do for the second episode? Well, we kind of did everything in the first episode. Okay, we need to calm down then. We can't have everything happen in one episode. We need to sort of space it out. So we do these jokes here, which means that if you a show from the mid-80s, Sledgehammer, which is a show that I call, that does the same thing. The first episode of that one, Under the Gun, where he takes down the sniper with the rocket launcher and destroys the building, and where he has the guy beat the crap out of himself because he doesn't have time to do it, the purse snatcher.
Didn't he also rescue a cat from a tree by chopping the tree down or shooting the tree down or something?
That's Police Academy. The great thing about the Sledgehammer episode is that he's so wonderfully unpleasant throughout, but then he has that great moment where he throws open the car door, knocks over the purse snatcher, and he's holding down the purse snatcher, calling him like, you scum of the earth, and da-da-da. And the lady who had her purse stolen walks up, and he's insulting this guy, you pinko, da-da-da-da-da. And then he picks up the purse, turns to the woman, and he's, you know, he's like, scum of the earth, scum of the... Here you go, ma'am. I'm so sorry. Things like this just shouldn't happen, should they? Thank you. And then he turns back, and there's this great moment we see he is a nice guy. But Sledgehammer does the same thing that Get Smart does. You watch the second episode where, like, this news reporter travels around with him and Doro and sees how crazy he is. And it's much calmer. And I remember my dad and I watched the first episode of Sledgehammer and we're in hysterics. We watched the second one and didn't laugh as much.
Yep.
And there is a feeling of sort of pulling away and, like, what is this show going to be? Is it going to be that first episode thing, or is it going to be the second episode? And that's very much, I think, like what this is. And although with less laughs, obviously, in the Bourbon Street Beat. But that's sort of what I thought of. Because I see that a lot with like second episodes, where like the first episode does one thing, and then you watch the second one, and you go, okay, where's this going now? And so I guess, do you have anything else for this one?
Maybe? No, just that I think that this sets us up for what is now obviously the pivotal third episode, where we'll find out which direction the show is going.
All right, cool. So, The Morning Cloak, excellent. Mitchell, where can I find you online? Where can others find? Where are you?
Where am I? I'm at www.itsabouttv.com, and the name of the blog is, oddly enough, It's About TV.
Excellent. And one of the great things that's on that site is you take old TV guides and you analyze them. You go deep into them. And I love that. Whenever you have one of those up, I always spend like 15, 20, 25. I don't know. I've never written down how long I spend looking at one of those columns, but they're always so good.
Oh, those are so much fun to write, too.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine. Yeah. So that's the second episode of Bourbon Street Beat. Next up is... I've forgotten, but I'm sure it's a great episode. Wait a minute. I can tell you. It is... I can't tell you. We'll do the next episode.
It's a good one. Torch Song for Trumpet. Or is it... Yes. No, The Morning Cloak.
It's Torch Song for Trumpet.
Okay, you're right. Yeah. This was The Morning Cloak.
Yes, this was The Morning Cloak, and a lot of the music in The Morning Cloak sounds just like this.
Bourbon Street Beat.
This famous nightclub owner is opening a rare vintage and his coffin. Who killed him? Was it the mind reader?
I have come here to help you identify the murderer.
The pianist?
I don't care who killed him.
The dead man's partner?
I know that makes me a good suspect.
The ambitious singer?
Oh, Johnny, what is it? What's the matter?
The clumsy wine steward?
The pain was excruciating.
Or was it someone else? Match wits with Ellery Queen and see if you can guess who done it.
Episode 12 of Ellery Queen Mysteries, The Adventure of the Black Falcon, originally aired on January 4th, 1976. Directed by Walter Doniger, written by Mark B. Ray. Didn't he direct and write Scream Bloody Murder, the first film that we could legitimately call gornography? I stand by that, even if I'm terribly wrong. This one begins at a nightclub, Nick and Eddie's, and Nick is preparing himself a lovely glass of wine in their extensive wine cellar, and we see someone pouring something into the wine. And then Simon Brimmer, looking like the super fop that he is, shows up. And he is... Nick and Eddie have a radio show. And Simon is on there. And he's going to talk about some sort of case or other. And we see Nancy McGuire, who's a singer. And I believe Ted Williams is her accompanist, Tab Hunter. The Amazing Armitage, played by the great and wonderful Roddy McDowell. There's like a restroom attendant there named Flora, who is German but sometimes says she's Dutch. And yes, and you got Nick and Eddie also, who are two older, sort of old school, not quite gangstery, but sort of older school gentlemen. And Simon is there. And look, who should appear but a tiny reindeer? No, who should appear but Ellery and his dad, because Ellery is going to arrest Simon if Simon gives anything away. Well, listen to this.
Would you look at these prices? 75 cents for a hamburger. That's outrageous. I can buy 3 pounds of hamburger for 75 cents.
So why don't we listen to his broadcast on our own radio at home?
I can't arrest him at home.
Oh, you're not going to arrest him?
No, I'm not, eh? In April, I was about to nab that Duffy woman in the Park Avenue penthouse murders. He went on the air, spilled the beans, exit Miss Duffy.
The radio show begins, and Brimmer is talking in not very nice terms about Inspector Queen when we see Nick down in the basement. Having a sip of the wine doesn't go well. He dies, and when he dies, he grabs a bottle of wine off of the shelf, and it shatters on the ground. The radio broadcast is broken up by the discovery of the body. Everyone goes down to the basement, finds this bottle of wine on the ground. The black, it's in German, but it says the Black Falcon. Some sort of vineyard in Germany, I believe. Stuttgart? Maybe not. But regardless, this guy is dead, and the suspects begin to pile up. And, It's interesting because there's a point where they're like, okay, well, examine the wine in that glass. He's been poisoned. And then the next morning in Inspector Queen's office, we get this scene.
Dad?
What?
Oh, it's you.
Sorry, Dad. I didn't know you were asleep.
What do you mean asleep? I was reading the preliminary med report.
Maybe we shouldn't have stayed up so late last night.
Late? 4 o'clock? On the Antonovsky case, I was up 92 straight hours without a wink of sleep.
How long ago was that?
What's that got to do with it?
Nothing, nothing. Here, have a donut. May I look at the report? Thank you. Well, they didn't identify the poison.
No chocolate.
No, they were all out. I got cinnamon.
I don't like cinnamon.
Odorless and tasteless.
Yeah, I'm stale. Next time, bring me crullers.
No, I meant the poison, odorless and tasteless.
Where does it say that?
Well, it doesn't, but it figures. You see, Nick was a wine connoisseur. He wouldn't have tasted it if it smelled funny, and he wouldn't have swallowed it if it tasted bad. But the question is, how did he drink it? There wasn't any glass.
Drank it out of the bottle.
How could he? The bottle wasn't open.
The bottle was cracked. There was wine all over the floor.
Maestro? Oh, Inspector, I see you woke up.
I'm always awake when I'm working on a case. Why is it because I want to rest my eyes, people make dumb remarks? What's the matter, Billy?
The lab just finished testing that broken wine bottle. There's no poison in it.
What?
Just ordinary table wine, nothing else. The lab tried every test in the books.
The man died of poisoned wine. He had a bottle in his hand, and you tell me it wasn't poisoned?
Inspector, that's what the lab told me.
And that's what I've been trying to tell you. He didn't drink that wine. He didn't drink any wine in the wine cellar. The bottles were all sealed.
What about the casks?
Empty, most of them. Nick didn't drink out of his hand. Killer might have taken the bottle and the glass. Don't ask me why. But maybe, just maybe, they can be traced.
They're fun. So, as always, we're not going to go too far into it here, but it sort of builds up where Brimmer takes the Black Falcon bottle to this woman, Flora, and shows her the Black Falcon, and she gets agitated, and it's the Black Falcon, oh my gosh, I'm not German, I'm Dutch, and then you also have like this Ted Williams and Nancy McGuire are leaving the club, because they've got a record contract, and Ted Williams has said out loud that he did not like Nick, and Eddie has said that he wanted to sell the club for ages, and Nick didn't, and so there are lots of people who are little problematic in here, and they actually get help at a point. The amazing Armitage, Mr. McDowell, who is sort of a psychic kind of guy, comes to visit the Queens one evening.
I wonder if Nick is trying to tell us something about his killer.
A dying clue?
Well, the way he was holding that bottle. We know it wasn't the wine that killed him.
Maybe he was trying to tell us it was a wine just like it.
What good would that do? Nobody liked that wine except Nick. No, that bottle has another significance. I'm going to check out everybody connected with this case for a possible link with that German vineyard.
Ellery, I think you're onto something. That's good thinking.
Well, actually, it wasn't my idea. It was Simon Brimmer's.
Brimmer? Oh. See where Jackie Robinson got 2 for $4 yesterday. Who could that be?
I'll get it.
If it's one of your girlfriends, take her into the kitchen. I don't feel sociable.
Yes?
I wish to see Inspector Queen. My name is...
The Amazing Armitage.
Extraordinary young man. You possess a psychic gift.
No, I saw your picture at Nick and Eddie's.
Oh.
Come on in, please. Dad?
I thought I told you that...
My humblest apologies, Inspector Queen. I know I am imposing, but my conscience would not permit me to remain away one moment longer.
Conscience?
Quite right. I have come here to help you identify the murderer of Nicholas Kingston.
You say you know who killed Nick Kingston?
I said no such thing. But I have experienced certain images today, strong and persistent.
Mr. Armitage is a mentalist.
A what?
Mentalist.
I have the power to see into men's minds.
That's very interesting, because I have the power to run characters like you in on charges of fraud and bunko.
And so we go along, and things are revealed, and I'm going to stop there, because as always, we're not going to go too crazy into it. But yeah, this is the adventure of the Black Falcon. Technically, we're in the second half of the series now, the back end of the series. This is the 12th of the 22 regular episodes, and you can see, too, the last one, Blunt Instrument, aired December 18th. This aired January 4th. So obviously it skipped Christmas week, but it also, the time slot changed. I'm not sure when it aired, but it's not airing at that time anymore because it would have aired January 1st. So it's airing 3 days later. What I'd always heard about this show was that the ratings were okay, but they refused to move the show out of the 40s, which was a budgetary problem. I believe we may have said this before. Yeah, like Wonder Woman had the same problem, and so it got canceled. But yeah, we're in the second half of the show, and it's still great fun. I will be honest with this one. This might be the episode where all the people with the accents get to be a bit too much. We had a lot of people with accents. With this, we got Flora with her German accent, and we have the amazing Armitage with whatever his accent is, and we got a lot of accents, and there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of Flora in it, who is fine. She has an interesting backstory as we go along, but for some reason, not a favorite character of mine. She reminds me a bit of, I know she's German, she reminds me a bit, though, of old Polish ladies I used to hang out with a lot. Not that I did this a lot, like, during my younger years, but my family's Polish, and so we ended up spending a lot of time with my grandmother and her Polish friends, and she reminds me a lot of them. And they were the ones who always used to say, you know, like when I would come back from L.A. to visit family, they would always be the ones who say, are you on crack? With a Polish accent. Are you on crack? No, I'm not on crack. Because I saw something about Los Angeles, and it says all the young people there are on crack. You shouldn't do crack. Do you know what crack is? It's a drug. What kind of drug? It's crack. It's a drug. You shouldn't do it. You don't even know what you're talking about. I do know what I'm talking about because I saw it on the television. We would have conversations like this for ages, you know. I think with all these episodes of Ellery, I go from there are ones I absolutely, absolutely love. The Auld Lang Syne. I think possibly. Let me just look at some of the titles here. Auld Lang Syne. Love the Mad Tea Party. The Chinese Dog. We're about to do Eccentric Engineer, which I adore. And there are just some episodes I love. And there are episodes that I really, really, really like. And then there may be one or two that I like quite a lot, but aren't my absolute favorites. I love Simon in this. I love the story in this. But for some reason, I never get involved in this one as much as I should feel like I should. I don't know if that's got something to do. I don't know. Maybe it's like a middle of the season something or other. I mean, because the previous episode was about mystery writers. This one is about nightclub entertainers. The next one, spoiler, is about boxing. And so I like all this. I like that each episode goes to a different place and has a different place to go to because there were only 22 of them plus the movie. But for some reason, this one, maybe it's the direction. Could be. I'll have to look to see what other ones. I mean, because the script is good, the acting is fine as always. You heard those scenes with Inspector Queen and Ellery; they're fantastic as always. Simon is super foppish as ever. I'm wondering if it's the direction is just a little bit bland in this because it doesn't grab me as much as the other ones do. And of course, as always, I'm not going to go into the ending. I'm not going to do that, so I won't spoil anything there. But the ending is satisfying. Not the best of the endings, but I think it's satisfying. And I mean, the location is great. The nightclub is super fun to hang out with and see all the acts. And Tab Hunter is great because Tab Hunter is always like he's the. I don't know if this is quite the right word or if this is nice, but he's sort of like the hunkier version of Richard Jackal from the previous episode. You know, like you ask him a question, yeah, he'll punch you in the face, but he's going to be a little better looking when he does it. Richard Jackal's a little more hard-boiled. And let's see what else we got in this one. We got, Roddy McDowall going through it as the amazing Armitage with that accent you heard. And, it's a very good episode in a show that averages excellent to brilliant. And I do not tell you to not watch it because every time we watch the series, my wife and I, we watch this episode. So I will not tell you to skip it. But if I had to pick one of the 12 we've done so far, not counting the TV movie because that was kind of a different bird, but of the 12 we've done so far, this is probably my least favorite, but I still love it. So it sort of has the feeling of kind of an episode. Maybe if you're like, I was just watching Doctor Who before I started recording this, sort of like an episode like from the new series, like an episode like maybe like The Long Game or The Idiot's Lantern or not quite Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, that does it. Night Terrors. Sort of just an episode that's kind of in the middle of the season that does exactly what it's supposed to do, but is not really superb. I think it could be down in the direction. I've got it actually playing right here, and it's just a lot of the camera moving back and forth and following people, and it's great when it's on Ellery and Inspector Queen, but when it's on all the other characters, it doesn't, like, Ellery doesn't make as much of a presence in this as he sort of should. It doesn't sink in, I think, as deeply as the other ones. Now, again, you know, this is all in aid of, you should still watch it. This is still the best. You know, another example. Warner Archive released a set, Mystery Horror Double Features, 3 DVD-R set with 6 great late 30s, early 40s horror films on it, ranging from the Never Heard of It Before But It's Wonderful Find the Blackmailer to the super fun Old Dark House movies, Smiling Ghost and Hidden Hand, to the really entertaining Mystery House, to the one of my all-time favorites, The Octopus, and to the okay Patient Room 13, or is it Patient Room 13A? It's one of those things with that set. Patient Room, whenever I watch it, that set, I always kind of watch them all together, like over the course of a weekend, I'll watch all 6 of them, and I always start with Patient Room 13A. It's the last one in order on the set, but I always do it first because it's my least favorite, but it's still a lot of fun. And this is kind of like that. I would still say watch it in order, though, because you get the build up with Simon and his, it's interesting. I'll say this and then I'll sign off. Simon is great in this, and there's a moment where Ellery goes to visit Simon in his studio, and as Simon is describing something, Ellery is playing with a big a fake door, which looks exactly like the door that they used in the Pharaoh's Curse. They used a fake door in that in one point. I won't tell you why. But it's in there. There's a fake door in there for whatever reason. And I saw that fake door and said, isn't that the fake door that they use in the museum in the Pharaoh's Curse? Is Simon Brimmer steal that from this museum, or did they steal it from him? Okay. Well, that is The Adventure of the Black Falcon. Like I said, the least favorite of the first of the first 12 episodes, but still really worth watching. And that's like picking your least favorite, I won't say child, picking your least favorite pet, you know. Still going to be your favorites. Still going to love them. So that is the end of that. And let's give you a little bit of Ellery. Ellery, please.
Well, I think I know what happened to you. This bottle of Morningstar wine not being where Nick Kingston thought it was should give you the solution. You know who the killer is now? Was it John Randall? Eddie Morgan? Nancy McGuire? The Amazing Armitage? Alexander the Wine Steward? Or somebody else? Let's find out. Auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you, Ellery. Now, you might be thinking to yourself right here, okay, we had 3 segments. This is the closing segment for episode 46 of Eventually Supertrain. It is not. This is actually the closing section for the Ellery Queen segment because I made a goof throughout. You may have been listening to what Ellery just said, and he said, was it John Randall? And you thought, was it who, where, what? And where was Ted Williams? Well, you know what? Ted Williams is a baseball player. Ted Williams is not the name of Tab Hunter's character. It's Randall. And I apologize to everyone in the world for goofing that up throughout that segment. I'm not changing it. I like to expose my shame. So please continue to go back, listen to my shame, and I'll just tell you real quick how it happened. I write the notes down as I'm watching, and we got the opening scene in the wine cellar. Then we got a shot of the sign, and the sign had the singer with Tab Hunter, the pianist, on it, but only the name of the singer. And then it had Mr. McDowell on there with Armitage, I think was his name. And then what happened is, so I saw the singer, wrote down her name, wrote down the name Armitage. I'm looking at the McDowell's character, the psychic guy. And then the camera pans up, and you see Simon Brimmer, and I wrote right here, FOP, with 3 exclamation points. And then the next note is Ted Williams, because he goes immediately to talk with the two guys, and he says, who am I replacing? And they say, Ted Williams. And so my next note is Ted Williams, and then several notes down is Mr. Randall's name. I made the mistake of thinking, because Ted Williams' name was in close proximity and I'm not a huge baseball guy, that was his name. I know this is a long explanation for why I said Ted Williams instead of the actual character's name, John Randall, 2 or 3 times, but I felt obligated. So now we take a deep breath as the Ellery Queen segment ends, and we commence the actual end of episode 46 of Eventually Super Train. Good night, everyone.